We have three very irregular guests with us tonight. That is to say, they are all members of the Baker Street Irregulars. And that is the top end of the vast array of organizations which persist across the years in study of and in celebration of the stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle about Sherlock Holmes. These are Holmesian scholars and Holmesian aficionados. Who are they by name? They are Dr. C. Paul Martin, who is indeed an MD, and he has had a wide experience as a physician up in Minnesota where he lives. Glenn Maranker, who is a collector of Sherlock Holmes volumes and is the former chief technical officer for Apple Computers. He now works full-time at his hobby, so to speak. And Daniel Poznanski, another avid Sherlock Holmesian collector, has been a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, and which is another one of the great Holmes societies. I haven't fully understood the complexity of the sociometry of Holmesian scholarship, but they're everywhere. And they live by, you guys call it the playing of the game. You play the great game.
We play a very intelligent game.
What is the game, Dr. Martin?
The game, I think, Milt, is that we take the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, although some of us, in fact many of us, believe that he was only a literary agent for Dr. Watson, whom you know, except for two of the stories, are narrated by him. And he says, this is what happened, etc. On two occasions, Sherlock Holmes had to narrate them. But we believe in our hobby, our avocation, that Holmes lived, both of them lived, their characters lived, but they were published by Dr. Watson through Arthur Conan Doyle.
And so the kind of the running fiction, though I will never again tonight refer to it as a fiction, the running understanding among Holmesian scholars and aficionados is Holmes really lived. Watson really lived. To be sure, Doyle lived as well, but he just helped get some of this stuff written by Watson published.
Well, some people thought he was fictitious.
Or possibly he may have been a figment of the imagination of Dr. Watson, for all we know. Yeah. But that means lots of other people lived as well. Irene Adler really lived. The evil Dr. Moriarty and his second-in-command, Colonel Sebastian Moran. They were all real people then, were they?
Absolutely. I mean, the assumption is that these were all true accounts of historical events, of real historical people. And so, for example, London was plagued during much of the Victorian era by this mastermind of crime who was responsible for...
The Napoleon of crime,
Napoleon of crime.
Holmes called him.
Napoleon of crime. He was responsible for half that was evil and all that was undetected.
What is so distinctive about Holmes, of course, is his great ratiocinative ability, his ultimate use of high rationality, deducing from evidence that others are too dull-witted to perceive or to perceive properly, and solving crimes essentially on the basis of circumstance visible to him, if not to other lesser beings. We see that demonstrated in the very first meeting of Holmes and Watson. I give you a classic line. I wish you would then elaborate and explain it. Holmes says, as upon being introduced to Watson in the chemistry laboratory where he's doing some work, Holmes says, "How are you? You have been in Afghanistan, I perceive." How did he know that?
Well, he looked at various elements of Watson, and he was very well taught by a real doctor named Dr. Joseph Bell in Scotland to examine everything very carefully. That is, Watson retold the story, but it was Arthur Conan Doyle who was the pupil of Dr. Joseph Bell at the University of Edinburgh. And he would look at the person's pocket, he would look at the various elements of his outfit and his hands and the calluses here and there. But I want to interject one thing, Mel, lest you think this is limited to the three of us.
Oh, Lord, no.
In tomorrow's talk that we are all three giving different talks tomorrow
at the Newberry Library.
I will be showing letters from Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman as they talked about Sherlock Holmes, and it was very real to them. Truman said in his letter he wished he had time to reread all of the stories that he had read before he was 12.
But let me bring you back to the question I was raising a moment ago.
Well,
how actually did Holmes so quickly perceive that Watson had recently been
In Afghanistan? Holmes would look at an individual, such as that case where he first met Watson, and he would see that there was a man of obvious military bearing. He was sunburned, which is certainly not something you're likely to come by in the British Isles. So in the Victorian period, in the 1870s, 1880s, where would a man be both have a military bearing and have seen a lot of sun? And the fact that he was a young man and back would indicate that it was an area of active action, that he had somehow been hurt or wounded. And when you put these pieces together, there's only one possible solution, and that he'd been in Afghanistan.
Because at the time of their meeting, there had been a major British military operation in Afghanistan.
Precisely.
In 1880,
at the Battle of Maiwand
was fought, and there's Watson, and he is injured on the field, rescued only by his orderly Murray, who threw him over the back of a donkey and proceeded to save his life. And of course, the battle
sounds like a poem by Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah, absolutely,
it was very much like that.
Well, but you know, Doyle was a personal friend of Kipling.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and Kipling wrote a poem about this particular battle. It's the second Afghan War, however, which was 40 years after the first one.
But again, you know, Holmes's maxim was that in the retelling of the tales, phrase it a little bit differently, but the key was to see and to observe. And so Holmes would see things like complexion, carriage, evidence of work in the hands, and then he would observe what would necessarily follow from the things that he had seen.
And of course he has one great maxim which he repeats more than once, that his basic method is to consider all the possibilities, consider all the hypotheses, we might say, eliminate all the ones that are impossible, and whatever one is left
is
has to
when
be
you
true.
When you probable. When you eliminate the impossible,
there we are.
Whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth.
What's an illustration of his doing that?
Well, let's see.
From any one of the many stories in the canon.
And then let's see if we can get one that would illustrate that the best. Actually, the Norwood Builder that we were talking about earlier, the Norwood Builder where the bloody fingerprint was found. And what happened is he observed when he measured the house that had been burnt, he said, something is not right here. Whatever is impossible, whatever is possible. Here was a house in which the dimensions did not fit the visible rooms. Therefore, there is a secret room, and that's where the villain was hiding.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps the most classical illustration of this point is in the story The Silver Blaze. Mm-hmm. In The Silver Blaze, a horse gets injured, and there's a watchdog or a dog nearby, and people are wondering why the dog did not bark during the night. And the reason the dog didn't bark during the night was because he knew the groom, and it was the groom that injured the horse.
The trainer.
That's a classical.
What's that great
trainer?
What's the great line?
Right. The dog that did nothing in the night.
Inspector Gregory says, but Mr. Holmes, the dog did nothing in the night.
Right.
That is the curious incident.
Yes,
exactly.
Lovely. We are about to pause for a quick round of commercials, and then we shall return to Paul Martin, Glenn Maranker, and Daniel Poznanski. I think we're going to look at some of the more obscure corners of Holmesian scholarship. There's a vast amount of work that's done by people like you in which they elaborate upon what's in the canon, fill in the missing spots, including, of course, attempting to recover the detail of some of the great adventures of Sherlock Holmes that were not written up by Dr. Watson. Watson mentions them, as, for example, the case of the giant rat of Sumatra.
The world is not prepared, Milt.
That's what Holmes said. The world is not prepared for the case of the giant rat of Sumatra. But others have since then investigated it. We might look at some of that scholarship as well. As we return directly after these words, our three guests tonight are all of them Holmesian aficionados and scholars, and they will all be giving talks, reading papers to anyone who shows up tomorrow morning at the Newberry Library. I imagine you've got to get there early because the place should be jammed.
Free of charge?
It's free of charge. Starts at what, 9 o'clock?
9 o'clock.
And those guests are C. Paul Martin, who is a physician specializing in internal medicine and family medicine, also has his own radio program as a doctor on a station in Minnesota, where once a week or so he gives medical advice and reports medical developments, I would imagine. And Glenn Maranker, who is a former chief technical officer for Apple Computers. And Daniel Posnansky was a professor at Harvard for a while and has been in the education business, so to speak, at Harvard and yet other institutions, and then was you owned a construction firm in the Boston area, is that right?
Large engine rebuilder.
And an engine rebuilder as well.
Right.
But all of them are Sherlockians. How many Sherlockians are there in the world?
I
think it's easier to count those that are who are not.
Well, I fear I'm not. Some of my best friends are.
Well, right. as one example, the largest Sherlock Holmes society on the planet is the Sherlock Holmes Society of Tokyo,
which has
5,000 members.
Right. Many of whom probably do not speak English.
Yeah.
Right. You know.
And the science societies, which is how we refer to these societies,
branches,
quite apart apart from the Baker Street Irregulars, are usually named after some relation to the Holmes canon. So, for example, the Japanese society that Glenn was referring to is called the Baritsu Society, which is the type of
Martial arts
and that Holmes was Holmes very himself, effective in.
But I wonder what they do with the name Holmes. You don't pronounce L in Japanese. It would be Horum, and he would be Horum-san.
Right, exactly.
Horum-san, don't forget the honorific.
Exactly. Yeah,
don't forget the honorific.
Right,
and, you know,
exactly.
At the other extreme, by the way, it's, as Dan said, these societies take their name from a story or some element of the canon. There is a science society in the Washington area called the Solitary Cyclist, which has one member.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be appropriate. And then my society is the Norwegian Explorers, because, as you remember in the canon, Milt, after Holmes allegedly went over the Reichenbach Falls with Professor Moriarty, he actually disguised himself as a Norwegian explorer by the name of Sigurdsson that traveled to Tibet. And in 1948, when our forefathers in Minneapolis, in St. Paul at the University of Minnesota, organized our society, Minnesota, of course, being filled with Germans and Scandinavians, they thought, what better
appropriate? Sounds like a natural tradition.
It's the Norwegian explorers.
But I've been waiting to find out, and at this moment I expect somebody will at last enlighten me, what was the real story about the giant rat of Sumatra?
Well, as we say, Holmes said it was not quite, the world was not quite ready.
But they must be ready by now.
Well, the giant rat of Sumatra has been examined, as you referred to books called pastiches, which are books written in the style of Conan Doyle, probably one of the highest compliments a person can do. But
there are literally hundreds and hundreds.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands.
Yeah. And some of them, as professor of English at the man that gave our lecture last year at one of the colleges in Maryland, said that there are some that are good, some that are bad, some that are terrible, and some that in all of them he's read.
Uh-huh.
But yes, the pastiches come on him because it makes money. In fact,
but will no one enlighten me about the giant rat of Sumatra? I've been wondering about that
years. We're trying to protect you.
In order to be enlightened, you have to read, and we won't divulge the contents, of a book by Rick Boyer, who wrote a book called The Giant Rat of Sumatra.
He did.
In which he elucidates his point of view, not necessarily Holmes's point of view. But the book is rather lengthy and goes on for a while, and you'll have to read that book to finally get to the conclusion.
What are some of the other titles of the untold stories?
Well, let's see. There's The Affair of the Aluminum Crutch.
Uh-huh.
And Riccoletti, the Club Foot, and his Abominable Wife.
Right. The Strange Disappearance of James Fillmore, who left the house with an umbrella one day and was never seen again.
Where does Watson mention these stories, these untold tales?
Well, they're in the body of others of the main story.
Is it in one particular story?
No, all throughout.
And you can imagine, Bill, it's sort of like the tease for the next program.
Right.
Of course, the real truth, the interesting biographical fact about Doyle is that he must have enjoyed himself and he had a wonderful conception, but he was more interested in or prouder of a lot of other writing he did.
He was also
profoundly obsessed with something that doesn't sound very Holmesian or very scientific, namely with an absolute conviction that spiritualism was a great and potent power, that ghosts and poltergeists appeared, and
fairies
be revealed through seances. Right. He spent a vast amount of his fortune trying to publicize and convince the rest of the world of that, didn't he?
Well, you mentioned two different and interesting things about Doyle. His real love, literature love, both what he enjoyed reading and what he really liked to write, were historical novels, mm-hmm. and in fact, many of them can really be called gothic novels. He read those extensively. He greatly admired, Sir Walter Scott, for example. He waxes poetic about his attachment to that literature, and that's the work he was proudest of. Nevertheless,
how many non-Holmes books did he do?
Wow.
There's also nonfiction that he did.
Yes, he did
major works on the war in South Africa.
In fact, I can tell you an interesting story about that, Dan. I was just in South Africa recently visiting mm-hmm. my son, and in a bookstore, it said History of South Africa, and there was one modern book, and then there was The History of the Boer War by Arthur Conan Doyle with a cartoonish front cover, the whole thing in paperback, and it was 100 years old, still being sold as a definitive history of the Boer War in contemporary society in South Africa.
Did you buy it?
No, I already have a copy of the original.
You're a collector, yeah.
I have the original, though.
Well, one of his nonfiction pieces of nonfiction, at least with in the popular masses, got him in a little bit of trouble. He wrote a book just after the turn of the 20th century called Danger, where he talked about the danger that British was an island nation and that submarine warfare was a possibility and could be crippling to the country. And when the Germans started in with submarine warfare, there were some lunatics who said, Conan Doyle, you gave him the idea.
In fact, some people thought he had gotten the idea from Edward VII, who was a friend of his, and, of course, the reigning monarch at that time. But that particular idea prompted another of his ideas, not fiction at all, but he proposed the idea of a tunnel under the English Channel from Dover to Calais, which, of course, now
we've got it. Yep. It's been there for quite a while.
But the danger story really prompted that.
We know, of course, that he got tired of Holmes and killed him off at the Reichenbach Falls, where he and the evil Dr. Moriarty go over the falls together to their death.
Ostensibly. To their death.
Because the public clamored for return of Holmes.
Very unpopular.
There was an interregnum of some 3 or 4 years, and finally,
actually, until 1902, when The Hound of the Baskervilles was published.
Although that was brought back with a convenient artifice. The Hound of the Baskervilles did come back 7 years later, but the story was conveniently set prior to the episode at Reichenbach Falls, so there was no need to explain.
It was a prequel.
So there was no need to explain his apparent demise.
It was 1905.
But later on,
in 1905, he well and truly came back.
And he does have to explain.
Yes, with a full explanation.
It's pretty tricky.
Very tricky.
What really happened at Reichenbach Falls?
Well, he had to avoid that evil Colonel Sebastian Moran, who was
possibly up on the ledge above.
That's right.
And throwing boulders down on Holmes.
And very annoyed.
Gentlemen, they'll be annoyed with me if I don't instantly go to the newsroom, where we will get an update from Steve Ruxton. And we come back to Extension 720 right now, simply for me to reintroduce our guests. And then, after a brief commercial interlude, we'll get down to what they're going to be talking about tomorrow. Those guests are Dr. C. Paul Martin and Glenn Maranker and Daniel Poznanski. Sherlockians all, members of the Baker Street Irregulars all. In fact, you each have a special Baker Street Irregular name.
We do?
That's what is done. Let me hear that quickly before we pause for those commercials.
Oh, well, mine is
Dr. Martin.
Dr. Leslie Armstrong, who was one of the greatest minds of Europe, head of the Cambridge Medical School, but unfortunately was outwitted by Holmes.
All the names come from the stories, of course. And Daniel Poznanski, you are?
Mine is Colonel Hayter. That's H-A-Y-T-E-R, who was the owner of a large amount of property. And I was given that name because, fortunately or unfortunately, at one time I did own a vast estate.
Yeah.
And so I was given that name.
Oh, now, Dan, I think in part you were given the name because Colonel Hayter also had a small but select library.
Yes, he did, I have to say. But I'm not sure that was the reasoning behind the name.
what's your name?
My name is The Origin of Tree Worship, which is...
doesn't sound like a human being.
Well, actually, in some ways, it's not. You know, it refers to my compassion, compulsion, consumption with books and collecting of books.
Paper, in other words.
Paper.
And, gentlemen, with that, we pause briefly for these messages, and then let's talk about... let's have capsule versions of the talks you're going to be giving tomorrow at the Newberry Library. And let's get capsule versions of what the three of you will be talking about tomorrow at the Newberry Library. Daniel Poznanski, what's your topic?
The topic is what Arthur Conan Doyle thought of the United States, or in America, we trust, basically. God bless America.
He was the Philo American, was he?
He was very much so a Philo-American, and there are many instances in the stories where he quotes and features Americans, both good and bad, both black and white, of all kinds and all sorts.
But was he ever over here? I suppose he must have been.
Oh,
yes.
Four times.
His first visit was in 1894.
To Chicago.
And that was one of the most famous in Chicago.
What was he doing in Chicago?
He was lecturing. And he had been given a series of lectures to present to the American public for the first time by James Pond, a very famous entrepreneur.
Well, he was lecturing on what subject?
Sherlock Holmes and other material that he wrote.
I see.
He suggested to Pond that he lecture on two other subjects, but Pond said no. Lecture on the material that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And Doyle says in a letter that I have and will be presenting tomorrow, an original Doyle letter, he says, you know, I tried to lecture on the other subjects, but I never could. And he winds up saying in the lecture to the Brits, if you don't join the United States, you will be doomed to be overshadowed by them. And that is the denouement of my lecture.
Mm-hmm. Do we know where he lectured? Literally the
yes,
location?
Yes, this particular letter is from Massachusetts.
No, but I mean, in Chicago, where did he lecture?
Well, he lectured at Mr. Higginbotham's
his itinerary is well known, and the places that I can bring to mind are his first talk was given at the 20th Century Club,
mm-hmm.
which met in Higginbotham's mansion. Apparently, in these days, the mansion had I haven't seen it, but it's referred to as a theater.
I see.
And he gave his first talk there. He also gave a talk in Chicago at Century Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So his itinerary is known in some detail.
In a few of his stories, there is some mention of Holmes passing through Chicago. In one story, Holmes reveals to Watson that when he's on the run for something or he's in disguise, he spent a month at Chicago, he says. The preposition is at rather than in.
Right,
I don't know
exactly.
And he also, shall we say, got the idea for a couple of, shall we say, unsavory characters who came from Chicago. One of them in the adventure, The Dancing Men.
Yeah.
There was a certain Chicago criminal by the name of Abe Slaney.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there was another one, too, that from Chicago.
And there's also, on the right side of the law, Captain Marvin of the Chicago Police, who is instantly recognizable as a good guy.
Uh-huh.
So, as I said, he took good guys, bad guys, black, white, married, unmarried, lawyers, all kinds of people from the
United
States.
You were telling me... off the air, I think, tonight, that President Franklin Roosevelt develops proof in a letter he's written to somebody that Holmes probably actually was an American.
He develops what Roosevelt refers to as a postulate, that is a theorem, that Holmes was definitely an American, of American parents, and got his firsthand knowledge of the way crooks operate from dealing with the lowlife of America. And that is how he first
His crooks are too good, are too crooked to be British.
He acquired his skills, right. And of course, he used these things over and over again, particularly in the story The Valley of Fear, which is all about the Molly Maguires and the labor movement, where Holmes actually is disguised as a member coming over to help solve some of these outrages.
So, you know, in fact, the affection for the you know these stories in this era, Roosevelt at Camp David gave the name to the area and the hut where the Secret Service stayed, Baker Street.
Really?
Yes. I don't know if it's still called that, but at least during the Roosevelt administration, it was so called.
The camp was there, but that was before they called it Camp David.
Yes, I apologize. But for the retreat.
The retreat.
Right.
Well, you know, Milt, that the criminal investigation computer program for the British is called Holmes.
Well, it makes perfectly good sense,
right?
But if people show up tomorrow,
they're going to get the real
story. They're going to see these real letters signed by Truman, signed by Roosevelt, all about their
feelings. You have them with you, I think.
Yes, I do. I have them
with me. You'll project them onto a screen, I think.
No, I have people come up and actually pick them up and look at them.
He shares them
with us. See these.
Now, Glenn, what are you talking about tomorrow?
Well, I'm talking about a bookish sort of topic. The title of my talk is When is a Book More Than a Book? And I'm talking about three books, which what makes them interesting is not the story that's told by the words inside the book, but the other story behind the books. So, for example, one of these books has a very interesting history. It was owned for a while by a murderer. It was then owned for a while by a fellow who ran a bunch of radio stations and then went into bankruptcy. I have another book which was
recovered. These are all books of Holmes stories or
these
Holmes
these
novels.
I've picked three examples. Many books have a story like this behind them and is what makes them interesting.
It's what collectors call the provenance.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
Where
has the object been? So one of the books I'm talking about, in fact, what distinguishes it was owned by Harlow Higginbotham of Chicago in 1894. And when Doyle was here lecturing, Higginbotham handed Doyle the book and said, would you please inscribe it for me, which he graciously did, which, of course, for any number of reasons might not seem all that remarkable, except the particular book was a pirated edition. And as you might imagine, the authors of the day did not feel too charitably towards pirate
publishing.
Pirated
means no royalties.
No royalties. No acknowledgement of copyright. No royalties. No nothing. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon.
In fact, Milt, Dan has a book. Why don't you tell him a little bit about your book with that Doyle has his own opinion of pirates.
Well, thanks, Paul. It was a book that actually turned up during Doyle's first visit in 1894 to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And you recall the poet Eugene Field.
Yes.
Well, there was a large line of people wanting Doyle's autograph. And Eugene Field, in his own inimitable style, ran to the head of the line and shoved under Doyle's nose this very ratty, tatty-looking pirate of the Sign of the Four, published by an American pirater. Doyle took one look at it, and he went bonkers, I would say. Mm-hmm. And he inscribed the book with a little quatrain talking about what he would do to the pirate if he ever got a hold of him, including walking the plank, literally. And on the title page, he put a publisher's circle around the name of the publisher and then drew a skull and crossbones in addition on this.
Which made the book instantly extremely valuable.
Well, it's interesting.
Tell me, when it comes to collecting of Holmesiana, or even more particularly of books relating to Holmes, or books by Doyle about Holmes, what is the rarest? What would be the one of greatest value? What's the one that you'd move heaven and earth to get into your collection?
Ah, well, you know, those are difficult and different questions, though they may sound
perhaps
the same, right?
Yeah.
But you know, there are there are books which are thought to be unique in some way. For example, the pirate Dan was just talking about.
Yeah.
Pirated edition with a quatrain and a, you know, Doyle's thoughts about pirateers. Well, there's nothing like that. It's unique. But the particular book that the particular book that I really, really, really would like to have is a copy of the British Hound of the Baskervilles in a dust
mm-hmm.
jacket. There are two known copies of that book. In all the world, there are only two known copies.
The original publication date?
1902. One of those two copies is in the Bodleian Library, so it's not going anywhere. So I think effectively, it's unique.
Unless somebody out there has one in their attic.
If there's a collector in Chicago that would consider parting with it, there's at least one ready buyer in Chicago today and tomorrow.
Three? Well, Milt, I have an interesting, it's not a book though. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow.
Yes.
I have a sketch that Doyle made on his deathbed, or near the time of his death, in which he embodied himself as a horse pulling a wagon full of his life's work.
Mm-hmm.
And in this wagon are several bundles labeled Sherlock Holmes, politics, the Boer War, his service as a physician, etc., along a street that shows the milestones of his life. And this is the only existing copy, the only existing print. There are copies, but this is the existing print which summarizes his life. And I've used it when I teach medical students about being a all-rounded person, not just a technician.
We are going shortly to some commercials, which we tend to do every now and again. Dan Poznanski, you are a great collector as well of Holmesiana. What are you after? What would gratify you most if you could get it into your collection?
Well, I think it's similar to Glenn, because dust jackets are so important.
Mm-hmm.
However, not the British Hound of the Baskervilles, but the first American edition of the Hound of the Baskervilles, of which I own the world's only known copy, as well as the dummy of the book, which is what publishers produced to give potential buyers an idea of
the book. You're not after this one. You've got it.
No, I don't have one with a dust jacket.
With the dust jacket.
I am looking for the first American Hound, 1902, published by McClure Publishers, if anybody out there has it, with the dust jacket.
What has that gone for in the past?
It's never been sold. It's never been found.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has any copy.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention how much the copies I have, which are the only known copies of this book, but they're in many, many dollars worth. But I will give you an idea, just to answer that question obliquely. The first appearance of Holmes is in a little paperback called Beaton's Christmas Annual.
Mm-hmm.
And the sale of that book has gone up consistently ever since its inception.
The magazine itself.
The magazine. Several years ago, at a major auction house, it brought over $160,000.
Mm-hmm.
I have the world's only known inscribed copy by Arthur Conan Doyle, and it will be available for viewing tomorrow at the Newbery Library. And it says, "This is the very first independent book of mine that ever was published." That's a direct quote.
So you know, I would estimate that's worth over
$150. It's worth something.
Well, it's actually worth a visit to the library tomorrow.
That's what it's worth.
To be sure.
Exactly.
If you have any curiosity in these sorts of things, this is an opportunity to see you asked about unique items. And, you know, there's a reason that collecting in this and this activity is referred to as a gentle madness. You have to, among other things, you have to be a little crazy. Is there?
That's true of almost all absolutely obsessive collectors, don't you think?
Avocations, right?
How true.
I wouldn't argue with that. Yeah. I wouldn't argue with that. But, you know, there are another example of value of unique or near unique items is when the British first of the Hound of the Baskervilles sold in jacket at auction, it brought £75,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, to finish the round on what you're going to be talking about tomorrow, we've only got about a minute and a half left. But, Dr. Martin, what are you up to tomorrow?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to talk a little bit about that particular sketch called The Old Horse.
Yeah.
Because it's the title of my talk is Arthur Conan Doyle, Dr. Arthur Conan Doyle, A Self-Portrait. Because here's a man that tells you. Now, if I was a psychiatrist, I suppose I could have a field day looking at the size and shape and priorities. But I'm going to give a general introduction to the phenomenon of Dr. Conan Doyle's life for the people in the audience who aren't Sherlockians, and then a little bit about everything else.
He was, I gather, a pretty good doctor.
I think he was a very astute physician.
Yeah.
Milton, he talked about infectious disease, about, in fact, the thing that's most interesting to me is there in the Cambridge History of Medicine, written by Roy Porter, who is a very well-known historical writer, in the Cambridge History of Medicine, he lists Conan Doyle as writing about medical literature, and he wrote a short story called A False Start, which is about how the patient needs a physician who will listen to him. And that's what we're hearing in the United mm-hmm. States and America right now.
We are going to the newsroom in a moment and then directly back. There's more to talk about regarding Conan Doyle and regarding his great creation, Sherlock Holmes, and to Paul Martin and Glenn Marenker and Daniel Poznanski. This invitation, let us now, at least for 10 minutes or so, engage in some literary analysis or some literary critical thought. Basically, I think the question I want to put to you is, why does it work so well? Why are the Holmes stories so deeply involving? Why, in fact, have societies like yours developed and flourished, and thousands of people live avocationally through their continued investment in the stories in all of their detail? Is there something about the relationship between Holmes and Watson which is the key to the success, to the penetrating presence of those stories?
I think there's no question that the interplay in the relationship between the two characters is critical. But I think the appeal in very large measure comes from a couple of things. One is that London, England during the Empire, mm-hmm. you know, the fog rolling down through the streets, you know, coal fires in the living room is very romantic, very appealing. And the character of Holmes is really remarkable. I think to simply think of these as detective stories is not possible, sells them short. There are enormously powerful figures of good and evil, good triumphs over evil, and Holmes is really a superhuman character. He can do things that you and I can't do. It's not that he's just a reasoner, and certainly he is, but he's able to reason about things and to accomplish things that ordinary mortal men can't.
Well, I think more, Milt, it's the, as I agree with Glenn, is it's the ambiance of the Victorian age.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that every one of us, you and I and the other gentlemen here, mm-hmm. everybody loves a puzzle. And, you know, and many, not all of the Sherlock Holmes stories, but many of them are puzzles, and you want to solve that. And, of course, the secret of Doyle's success was that he didn't have to introduce new characters every time he wrote the story. He was one of the first people that used the serialization idea, and also the fact that his stories could be read on the train 20 or 30 minutes. So I think it's the dynamics of the two to some extent, the fact that you know who they are, you know their little quirks, and then you're always looking to see if you can come to the answer before someone else does. And you look at the successful detectives afterwards. Agatha Christie openly admitted that she copied her ideas from Conan Doyle, who copied his from Poe and Gaboriau and Wilkie Collins. So I think that's it's the puzzle solving.
Christie's Hercule Poirot is also a rational machine in a way,
right? With a very unusual character,
rather eccentric and rather charming. sort of a fat Belgian.
Yep, that's right.
With waxed mustache and so on.
He was the OCD, right, of his age.
Yes, but he often says of himself that what gives him his advantage is his little gray cells.
The little gray cells.
Yeah, meaning his capacity for
thinking,
for ratiocination.
I think the mark that he started his day with also probably helped. The alcoholic drink.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
There's an aspect of Holmes that we haven't talked about at all.
Oh, yes.
Holmes was a serious drug addict, was he not?
Well, I'm not sure I'd come that way. Dan, what do you think?
He takes both cocaine and morphine.
Well, no. Before we get to that subject, which is a huge subject all to itself, my take on why people love this story is really the title of my very first talk in Harvard, 1968. The talk was Sherlock Holmes, an enduring and universal hero. People love stories about real heroes. As Glenn said, and Paul, the atmosphere is certainly superb. As President Truman said, it takes you back into a day that is much calmer, and God, if he could only get back to that day after having dropped a bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is when his letter was written. However, at the bottom of it all is someone who triumphs in a major way with good over evil, over the Moriartys and the Sebastian Morans. That triumph, that enduring and universal hero, is to me what makes Holmes so great.
He's always for the underdog, too.
He is.
You can identify with that.
All true. But what about his drug addiction?
Well, first you must remember, Milt, speaking as a physician, it was not illegal to use cocaine until 1911.
And it was taken in the form of laudanum by young ladies,
right? And
young ladies.
Right, and we also gave it to our children
to
calm their intestines, powder tincture of opium. But, if you're going to write a story, you can't have some Joe Average. You've got to have somebody unique. Look at some of these television characters. Or like you say, Perrault, perfect example. Mm-hmm. I think that Holmes was an epic character, and so Doyle made him different. He didn't like women, allegedly. He was much taller than any British citizen, 6'2", it is felt. He had this uncanny mind and this very unhealthy habits.
And he played the violin.
Poorly, to some extent, but...
But from early on, Watson is concerned about the fact
that
Holmes, when he's bored, is taking cocaine.
In fact, it was the nitus of a tremendous movie, as you mentioned, The 7% Solution.
Nick Meyer's
book, right. Nick Meyer's book, yeah. And then a very entertaining movie, too.
Well, some respects, many respects, Holmes was a real person and a flawed person. And one of his flaws is he used cocaine, and that this was, as has been observed, it was not illegal in those days. It's also not, you could go to a tobacconist and buy it. It was not difficult to come by. But it's clear in the story from references by Watson, for example, that this is a destructive habit, and that he shouldn't be doing it, that it was not a good thing, not a respectable thing. And, in fact, during this course of his career, in particular in The Three Students, he was weaned from the drug and didn't return to it anymore.
Yeah, Watson takes it as his...
As his mission to save his friend from, ultimately from
Watson
destruction.
Speaking of Watson and Holmes as a pair... Which was the best pair of all in the films? We've had so many different Holmes-Watson combinations. The one that sticks in American memory, at least, maybe it's worldwide, is, of course, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce.
Let me step back a bit. Milt, in the stories, they were actually quite close in age. They were not young and old as that. And Bruce, of course, was a bumbling sort of character, which Watson never was. He was very trusted. I think some of the James Mason film, about Jack the Ripper. What's the name of that gentleman? I can't remember it right now. They're showing it in Canada next month. James Mason and trying to think of the man that played Watson, but it was
Mason as
James. He played Watson. He played Watson.
And who's the home?
Murder by Decree.
Murder by Decree.
Murder by Decree.
And the
I don't know the film.
Oh, it's a wonderful film. Yeah. It portrays Holmes tracking down Jack the Ripper with all the theories about Eddie. You know, the Duke of Clarence. And
yes. Who's the Holmes?
Well, to my mind, absolutely, Jeremy Brett. And Edward Hardwick were a terrific, the best.
Brett is
Holmes
a rather overstrung Holmes, a very twitchy Holmes.
Absolutely, but you know, I don't. My conception of Holmes is that while admirable, while gifted, while the champion of people in trouble, was probably not a very likable fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And so that part of it rings true to me.
It might have been Christopher Plummer, I think, but maybe one of our listeners can call in and tell us.
I'm sure they can. And speaking of our listeners, we're lined up on the phones. All the spots are taken. If you're trying to reach us, you're not getting through, but that is, you're hitting the busy signal. But the proper strategy, of course, is to try again right after we say goodnight to some prior caller. And in just a moment, after a quick round of commercials, we will go to the phones. The number remains 591-7200. And for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. Right on to your contributions after these words. And a quick reintroduction of our guests, and we'll go directly to the phones. They are Daniel Poznanski, who is an avid Sherlock Holmes reader, as are all three of our guests, of course, and a very busy Holmes collector. And as are all of our three guests, a member of the Baker Street Irregulars. Glenn Maranker is an equally avid collector of Sherlock Holmes material, especially books, and is the former chief technical officer for Apple Computers, though now retired and working full-time at his avocation. And Dr. C. Paul Martin is indeed a physician with a specialist in internal medicine and family medicine, and is a member of the Baker Street Irregulars. Of course, you're all members of it, but in different groups because you live in different cities. You live up in Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Martin. Glenn lives in
San Francisco,
and Daniel lives...
Kennebunkport, Maine.
You and your friend down the road...
Mr. Bush.
Mr. Bush, yeah. Right. Bush Senior.
Senior, that is. The president.
And we go to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you so much, Milt. Gentlemen, the game is afoot. I understand that most people's introduction to Sherlock Holmes was through the serializations in Strand Magazine. And I was wondering, you were talking about collections before. Are there any collections of the magazine that are available?
Okay.
I could buy them, but I mean, are there...
Are they to be seen?
Right.
Yes,
they exist.
Thank you for your call, and I hope to see you tomorrow at the Newbury Library.
Oh, I'm glad to be there.
And I'm going to show you some pictures of the Strand Magazine, and you'll be happy to know that the Strand Magazine is available through many used booksellers, and is not terribly expensive. You could probably get a bound copy of a half a year or a year of the Strand Magazine containing a few of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And in fact, some of his non-Sherlock Holmes stories, medical ones, for less than $50.
Well, also, there's a reasonably new, and I apologize, I don't remember the publisher, a facsimile edition of the Strand.
Oh, yes.
Which you could probably get at just a used bookstore for not much money.
And it has the characteristic red cover. Very bright red cover.
The publisher, the publisher is Avenel Books.
A-V-E-N-A-L.
And we thank you, ma'am, for the call. Let's try to service lots of calls. At the moment, there's one line available because we just said goodnight to the first caller. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening. Are you there? Hello, hello. Going once, going twice, and gone. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Oh, good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. My compliments and my thanks, as always. I'm wondering if your esteemed guest would please comment on Dr. Bell, under whom Dr. Doyle studied, and also Sherlock Holmes' loneliness always went right. And I was wondering if Moriarty was his enemy. I read somewhere that Moriarty had an affair with Sherlock Holmes' mother, and I just thought the loneliness was so striking.
Ma'am, we're having a little trouble hearing you. Your cell phone isn't projecting too well, but I think we get the general drift of it. Let's get some response. Glenn Marenker.
Well, certainly Dr. Bell was a gifted physician and instructor in med school in Edinburgh, where
Doyle was
a student, and had a great influence on Doyle, and in particular, not only because of the medical training that he imparted, but Bell's uncanny ability to look at, in real life, look at a person and deduce things about their occupation or where they might have acquired their medical difficulties. And this is in multiple places very enthusiastically and warmly confirmed by Arthur Conan Doyle.
Our thanks to that caller. Here's an email that confuses me a bit, but maybe you can unravel it. This fellow's down in Kansas, in Abilene, and he emails as follows. A couple of years ago, I came across a book. It is a compilation of detective stories written by Arthur Conan Doyle. None of these had anything to do with Sherlock Holmes and were billed as written before there was a Sherlock Holmes. I began reading and soon found that these stories must have been rewritten with the Holmes character added and included in the Sherlock Holmes stories later. Is this a correct assumption? Do you know what he's talking about?
No, but Doyle did write many works prior to the Sherlock Holmes stories, and it is conceivable, although I've never heard of them, nor I think do my colleagues, of Doyle stories that were afterwards augmented by the insertion of a Sherlock Holmes or Dr. Watson character.
Yeah, Milt, he did write it. One of his first stories he wrote as a medical student was called The Mystery of Sasassa Valley, about a skull found in South Africa, as I remember. That was kind of a detective story, but I wonder if this man is confusing with The Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes, which was a book written in the 1940s by Ellery Queen, which were parodies of Sherlock Holmes stories written by Mark Twain, Bret Hart, and others.
Mark Twain?
Yes.
Did a parody of
He did a double-barreled cigar case.
Is that a fact?
Which is a parody, and Bret Hart wrote one. And
did they capture the Doylean style?
Well, it depends if you're a purist or not. Actually, I thought they were, those were very clever and bright men.
I'm sure they were.
They were called The Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes.
There were also a couple of stories which were collected in Round the Fire stories. Fair of the Lost Special, which are mystery stories. Holmes and Watson do not appear in them. They're two unnamed figures, though, which a fair-minded person might say are Holmes and Watson.
They're a lost train, in fact.
The lost special.
About a train.
Well, there's a vast amount of these so-called pastiche stories.
Well, these weren't pastiches. Well, they were actually written by Doyle, but as Glenn said, they only mentioned a London detective.
But what do we mean by pastiche?
A pastiche is a story which sort of celebrates the era and the characters, and covers a wide variety of actually genres. They can be serious attempts to reproduce the style and the atmosphere, or they can be burlesques. They can be jokes.
But there are thousands of
uncountably many. They've been written by Bret Hart. They've been written by Mark Twain. They've been written by Isaac Asimov.
Right.
You know, just
does Asimov take Holmes into space or what? He was a great science fiction writer.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes. Don't forget,
and a member of the Baker Street Radio.
Don't forget that besides being a passionate Sherlockian, Isaac Asimov wrote a book in every category to do a decimal system.
Yes,
so
right,
not just science fiction.
Yes, that's right.
He's very proud of that.
In fact, Milt, there's a series of pastiches written about Minnesota history by a man, a writer for the St. Paul paper. One of them solves the Ice Palace murders in St. Paul. One of them solves the Kensington Runestone, which was you've maybe heard that story. They're fascinating stories, but using Holmes and Watson as the opening to get people's readership.
Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. Here's the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you. Oh, wonderful program. It seemed like a few of the Sherlock Holmes stories that I read reflected popular prejudices of the time. And in one of them, the malefactors were Greek, and portrayed Greeks in a, you know, a negative view. Another one I can recall portrayed Mormons as in a negative point of view. I'm wondering how many other instances there might have been where the story sort of reflected the popular prejudices of the time.
Well, the Mormon stories, obviously you're referring to the Valley of Fear. To the Study in Scarlet. And, of course, we're facing the very same situation today as we did then. It's not too long ago, and I mean days, that a prominent Mormon was arrested for having too many wives. So this is still going on. It's not necessarily simply a product of the Victorian age, but it's still happening today. And then there are various other things. For example, we talked about Holmes's drug use. Well, in those days, not only was there legal drug use, but the use of opium was very heavy. And one of the stories in particular, The Man with the Twisted Lip, focuses on an opium den in a certain section of London on Swandam Lane.
The famous Bar of Gold.
Bar of Gold. And Hugh Boone, who is the character, decides to mask his face and use stage makeup to beg for change, and he makes a lot more money, as do some people today, getting change. Particularly if you're from New York City, you will find these people. And one particular woman in New York was arrested several years ago for getting thousands of dollars and then being picked up every night by her limousine. So it's still going on.
Yeah, Milt, I think it goes back to what makes a good story. And if you're going to sell stories, you got to take topical ideas. And he looked in fact, there's been a book called A Study in Sources, which a man examines where did Doyle get his ideas. And one of them, when he wrote The Study in Scarlet, the British newspapers were filled about the Mormons. He wrote about the Ku Klux Klan. He wrote about famous murders and manipulated them a bit. He wrote about Palmer and Pritchard as famous poisoners in the character of Grimsley Roylott, who was he said something very offensive to doctors, but probably true. He said, doctors are the most dangerous criminals. They have the knowledge and the wherewithal.
We thank the caller, and a quick stop for an update on the news as we go back to the newsroom and to Christopher Michael. And I see that we've now got a few spaces available on the phone board, so if you've been trying to reach us, do by all means make another quick try, and somebody will get through on 591-7200. 591-7200. We've got a lot of email that's accumulating. And after one more phone call, I'll read you one or two emails as well. Here is the next call. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I must say I've enjoyed the conversation this evening, and I would like to let your listeners know that after they go to the Newberry Library tomorrow, they need to turn around and head west and go to Rockford, Illinois, to Discovery Center Museum, because we've just opened up an exhibit on Sherlock Holmes, a traveling exhibit that's going to be there for 3 months.
What's in the exhibit?
Well, I guess the best way to describe it would be an interactive short story. It's set in Victorian England, and it uses the stylistic motifs and literary jargon of Doyle, and a murder has been committed. A body was found, and the culprit's at large. And there are 8 rooms, and with each room there is a quote-unquote chapter to read through the story. And then you read the chapter, you go into each of these period rooms, and there are clues and red herrings.
Now, are you using a real Sherlock Holmes story or one that's...
Pieces from different stories.
Oh, I see.
And
mm-hmm.
as you travel from room to room, then there are actually quotes from different stories.
Who worked this up?
On the walls. It was created by Innovative Exhibits. And it's been traveling the U.S. and Canada. I believe this is the start of its 9th year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually based on a replica of an exhibition in London. And so when you travel from room to room, there are period furnishings. And
what is the Discovery Center that you mentioned?
Discovery Center is a children's science museum located in Rockford. But this exhibit is really for
grown-ups.
Well, for certainly for children who can read, who are good readers, but most certainly for adults as well.
Well, thank you for the for the notice.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
All right,
see you tomorrow.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. 591-7200 is the number. Some lines available. If you move quickly, you may well get directly on our board and shortly on the air. Let me read you this email. Some years ago, I attended a talk at a local Sherlockian society by author Robert Goldsborough, which presented a considerable body of circumstantial evidence that Holmes was the father of Nero Wolfe. By the way, Robert Goldsborough, whom I know, has written at least two, maybe three Nero Wolfe pastiche mysteries and done them rather well. He was on this program once some years ago. But going on with this, I have heard of other theories that relate Holmes to other famous literary detectives. What do you think of these connections?
Well, certainly the thought that Nero Wolfe was a child of Holmes. In fact, some people have speculated he was the child of Irene Adler
and
Sherlock Holmes. But I think it's fanciful. I don't think... I think Holmes was an asexual being.
But also we... someplace in the Nero Wolfe canon, which is quite vast, we discover that he was born in Montenegro.
Exactly so.
Nero Wolfe was born.
Exactly so.
But and that's, again, the theory that Glenn just mentioned is thought, no scientific proof.
And that's why it's a little far-fetched. Now, you recall that it was Franklin Roosevelt himself that thought that Holmes was born in the United States. He does not discuss his parentage except to say that Holmes mingled with the criminal classes. But that's about as far as we'll go.
And Milt, remember, Irene Adler was an American.
Yes, she was the woman, that is, he always refers to Irene Adler as the woman. Supposedly, according to interpreters of the canon, she was the only woman that he ever loved. Is that right?
Well, I think it was the only woman that had a very strong positive effect on Holmes. I think it would be overstating things to say he loved her, but he was struck by her intelligence, her dignity, her beauty, but it sort of is an abstract idea.
Does she appear only in The Scandal in Bohemia?
Yes. Or? That is the sole, yes. The only appearance.
Right. Which was the first of the short stories.
And she has this wonderful ability, since she was an opera singer of some repute, to appear in costume. And in one of the episodes in The Scandal in Bohemia, she is dressed as sort of a man. We won't speculate on the entire figure, but nevertheless, it's clearly a man, and she says, "Good night, Mr. Sherlock Holmes." Sherlock recognizes the voice, but he's not quite sure who it was. And in the denouement of the story, of course, it becomes clear that it was Irene Adler. She got the better of him. She removed the incriminating photographs before he ever got to her house. And that was the end of the story.
But as a measure of her intelligence, she wasn't exactly sure what Sherlock Holmes looked like. And so she did this artifice of dressing up as a man and saying good evening to him to see if he responded, to see if that indeed was Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
And of course, Mel, from that, a whole string of pastiches about Irene Adler and Holmes has evolved.
I have seen one film, I think, in which during that period of disappearance, some 3 years after the Reichenbach falls, he is brought back to health and goes up and down the Nile or something with Irene Adler. Have you run across that?
No.
No, I can't say I have, but I would say that is fanciful at best.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will say one thing, Milt. The Science Society at Harvard in Cambridge, which I had the pleasure of founding, is called the Friends of Irene Adler. And the reason is she needed all the friends.
You say Irene, and in other productions, she is called Irene.
In Boston,
Irena.
In Boston, we say Irene. However, that might be conflicted with the song "Good Night, Irene," but that's how we speak.
Well, your British pronunciation of that name is
right.
Irene.
Yeah. Well, Irene. You're absolutely right about these varied pronunciations. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that those are affectations. She was an American.
So she's Irene.
She was an American.
She
wasn't an Irene.
Born in New Jersey, for crying out loud.
She was.
And with that, we pause briefly for some commercials, which will also bring us back to American reality. And then we return to C. Paul Martin, Glenn Maranker, Daniel Posnansky, and to your calls to them on 591 7200. As I have wondered before out loud after the ad we just heard, if I go to the jewelry exchange tomorrow, can I trade in two Cohens and a Shapiro for one Rothschild? But right now the question is, and the questions are about Conan Doyle and about Sherlock Holmes. Gentlemen, I want to read you an interesting email about Doyle and Houdini. This says, they were friends. Houdini set up an elaborate magic trick and then told Doyle exactly to what lengths he went to perform it. This was to prove that he, Houdini, did not possess magic powers. Doyle still believed that Houdini had some mystical power. This story is reported in Skeptical Inquirer magazine in a recent issue. Do you know that story?
Yes, I
Houdini
know.
Houdini was set to disprove that spirits did not appear.
That's right. It was
after their passing.
He had sort of a schizophrenic interest in it, Milt. Houdini missed his mother died at a younger age, and he desperately missed her, and he wanted to prove, he wanted Doyle and his wife, who was a medium, to bring her back to visit. And there's an interesting story about that, but pertinent to that person's concern. They were friends. They really wanted to expose the fraudulent media which spiritualism brought out. But I would recommend that any of you interested in this watch a movie which is presently being shown called The Illusionist, which has a lot of Doyle background into it, and you'll draw your own conclusion afterwards.
Well, but you know, Milt, the fact of the matter is that because in the modern era, I think because in the modern era we have so little regard for spiritualism and we really don't give the respect that this episode in Doyle's life deserves. He had lost his faith as a Catholic as a young man in his late teens. And he made a very serious and genuine attempt to find some other modes of thought to believe in. He studied theosophy, lots of things. And spiritualism seemed to grab him.
He devoted a good part of his life and a good part of his fortune to
a tremendous amount of money.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if it wasn't for the ongoing stream of royalties, there was no money left when he died.
Well, let me say with regard to Houdini, they started out as good friends. They wound up as bitter enemies.
Oh, really?
I have a letter of Doyle's where he states that Houdini is nothing but a publicity hound, and if Houdini, when he died, met the angel Gabriel, he would remove the horn from Gabriel's hands and blow the horn himself just to get the publicity. So what started out as a wonderful friendship wound up in a very destructive relationship.
Because Doyle wanted to believe. That's why he got in trouble with the Cottingley fairies, which was, again, it was another episode similar
to
the
two English girls who said that there were fairies in their garden.
And they essentially were paper dolls pasted to leaves.
Well, they produced photographs of this.
Yeah.
And he
didn't want to embarrass the girls. But look at this Loch Ness monster. Yeah. It took, 30 years for a surgeon to admit that he faked it.
But isn't it interesting that a man who creates a character who's the personification of rationality could be so easily suckered by two little girls pasting things on the trees?
Well, he wanted to believe. Some years ago, I came across several photographs of garden gnomes. Mm-hmm. These photographs were found in an old blazer of Arthur Conan Doyle at a second-hand store in England, and there's a direct line, we call it provenance, as you mentioned before, of these photographs. They were nothing more than gnomes, garden ornament gnomes, yet Doyle believed that these were real spirits.
Mm-hmm. We go back to the phones, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Oh, I think it must be me. Hi.
It's somebody who does a very good imitation of you, actually.
I'm a very big admirer of Laurie King's Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes books, and I'm wondering what your guests think of it. And I'll get off the phone and listen to their answer. Thanks.
Well, hold on a minute. What were the other names you just gave us? She's gone. What was she saying?
Laurie King, Mary Russell. Some stories about a young woman who is a detective. I think they are extremely well done.
They're mystery novels. Right.
Mystery novels.
Most of them are about San Francisco. They take place in San Francisco, and many of the stories revolve around some element of Sherlock Holmes. The guy is Sherlock Holmes collector or this and that, but not the character Sherlock Holmes. She has a detective. Mary King is her detective, and she's excellent, really.
Here's an odd one, at least something that I know nothing about because I don't know the television show of reference. Any thoughts regarding the popular television show House, starring British actor Hugh Laurie as a modern-day medical Sherlock Holmes? Brilliance, arrogance, addiction, and accomplices.
Well, actually, I've seen that show, although I'm not a fan of it. One of my patients, who was a philosopher, called me one night and said, would you watch it for me and give me a critique? I watched two shows, Milt, and it was so ridiculous and out of the norm that I did not find it entertaining, and the diseases that they talked about were so unusual that it was beyond entertainment.
It's called House in the sense that the doctors refer to a hospital?
No, that's his name.
Oh, his name is House.
Yeah. His name is also Dr. House.
Dr. House.
Also, the hospital is House, usually.
Right. But as opposed to Holmes.
Holmes. That's right. House and Holmes. Yeah.
Oh, I get it. I see.
Right. But, but it is a takeoff a bit, and he's a wonderful actor. But if you watch carefully, if you're a good Holmesian, you notice in one episode he's limping with one leg and using the cane in the wrong leg.
Yes.
Plus, he also takes drugs.
Yep.
Very heavily addicted to painkiller.
And he also way too acerbic to his inferiors, which Holmes did not do.
We pause for a last round of commercials, and there are some spaces available again. If you've been trying to reach us all night, make another quick try. You will, in all likelihood, get through if you move quickly. 591-7200. And, of course, there's infinite room on the email. The email address, extension720@tribune.com. And directly back to the phones. After I make clear, because some people may have joined us late, that C. Paul Martin, Glenn Maranker, and Daniel Poznanski, who've been talking with us about Sherlock Holmes tonight, will be talking at the Newberry Library in more extended lecture form tomorrow. That's to all comers. It's open to the public, no charge.
And it begins at 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock at the Newberry. 591-7200. Oh, and before we go back to the phones, something about the Newberry's own collection. What do they have that relates to the study of Holmes?
Oh, the holdings of the Newberry are phenomenal. And while the Newberry some years ago did have some excellent things, Dr. Fred Kittle gave his very substantial Doyle and Holmes collection, which Dan is very familiar with.
He gave the collection to the Newberry Library completely altruistically, and one of the major points of the collection is the manuscript of Doyle's non-Sherlockian novel, The White Company. This is a very rare thing, and if you come tomorrow to the lecture that the three of us are doing, you'll find references to those materials. It is one of the world's largest collections on the Doyle family.
Who is Dr. Kittle?
Dr. Kittle is a retired cardiovascular surgeon who worked here at Rush Medical Center.
I've heard his name, but I've never met him.
Yes, a very pleasant man. I actually met him 40 years ago when he came to the University of Minnesota when I was a medical student, and he was a professor of surgery at the University of Kansas. And he gave me my first injection of Conan Doyle, you might say. and he gave a very nice paper about Doyle, the physician, to a group of physicians. Mm-hmm. And I thought, and then in my naivete, I heard that he owned a manuscript called The Romance of Medicine, which, of course, would be something I'd love to have. So when I first met him, though, I then realized that collectors always buy but never sell.
And he's a native of Chicago.
Yeah.
Who wrote, I believe, his first paper in 1955.
And he's listening tonight, Milt. Make sure we don't make any mistakes.
Well, our regards and greetings to him. And here is another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, sir, I'm very much exasperated. I was going to ask you about Houdini, then about the fairies. And all I've got left is to ask whether all of you have a favorite story. I'm partial to the Red-Headed League.
The Red-Headed League is great fun. I've always enjoyed that one a great deal. But though I'm very much motivated now to go back and take my Sherlock Holmes volumes off the shelf.
Or get
and,
some new ones, right?
Read them again or get some new ones. But your favorite Holmes story?
Oh, I'm inclined to agree with the caller. Of the short stories, absolutely The Red-Headed League. But overall, The Hound of the Baskervilles is my favorite story.
It was a what's the great line? It was a
dark and stormy night.
No.
You know where that's from.
It was a great gigantic.
They were the footprints of a gigantic hound.
They were the footprints of a gigantic hound.
Said by a doctor. Of
course. And those are stirring, yeah. To say the least.
The Red-Headed League, I agree with Glenn entirely, is one of my favorite stories. And once again, it features an American or a supposed figment of someone's imagination who was supposedly left this great fortune for red-headed people. But it is all a ruse by a famous bank robber to get people out of the way so he can tunnel into the bank. That, to me, is fabulous.
The man who wants to get out of the way, of course, is red-headed.
Exactly. So he concocts this story, and all these red-headed people in London line up hoping to be the one that has to copy out, in order to get the prize, the pages of all the issues of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
I thought the interesting thing about that story, Dan, is it was written in 1891 or so, and yet in the 1970s, somebody used the same idea to rob a bank.
Actually got his criminal scenario from the story.
That's right. And then my favorite story is The Adventure of the Creeping Man, because it is a medical story. It's about a man who falls in love with a young lady, and he is of advanced years. So to, recapture his virility, he uses injections of monkey testosterone, which, of course, sounds absolutely ridiculous.
What year did Doyle write that story?
And it was written in the 1920s, and at that
time... Because at that time they were pushing that.
They were doing it.
Right.
A man by the name of Baranov, a Russian physiologist, actually published that idea.
And there was somebody, an American doctor some sort of faker, who... Goat glands, somebody he was called. It was goat glands, not monkey glands. Mm-hmm. But he was also promising virility. He broadcast from a super powerful station in Mexico just across the border. And for many years, he had a vast following in this country. People would come down there to get his goat glands injections for boosts to their virility.
The Viagra of the day.
That's right. The pre-Viagra, that's right.
Yeah, fascinating. We are just about out of time, gentlemen.